You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, we'll review the day's top news stories here in the studio with Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey. We'll go from Moscow and Homs to Johannesburg and Nigeria.
This sort of hashtag is really being owned by the Nigerian people. It doesn't have the feel of a kind of foreign imposition by well-meaning if wrong-headed activists.
Then we'll check in with our woman in Bamako, Alex Duval Smith. And later in the show, oh yes, it's Eurovision time, and today we interview the favourite to win this year's contest. Yes, it's the contestant from Armenia. All that plus Stacey Wilson from The Hollywood Reporter, and a bit more music too, coming up here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then on today's programme. Before we begin, let's get the latest news from all around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. Up to 300 people may have been killed in the latest attack in Nigeria by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. So far, 125 bodies have been recovered from a village in the northeast of the country. It comes 3 weeks after the group seized more than 200 schoolgirls. Britain is to send a military team to advise the Nigerian operations searching for them. The country's Prime Minister David Cameron said the kidnappings were outrageous.
I'm the father of two young daughters, and my reaction is exactly the same as his and every father or mother in this land or in the world. This is an act of pure evil. It's united people across the planet to stand with Nigeria to help find these children and return them to their parents.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has said a planned presidential election in Ukraine is a step in the right direction. He's also called on pro-Russian separatists to abandon plans for a referendum on independence from Kiev. But NATO says there is no evidence to support Mr. Putin's claim to have withdrawn tens of thousands of Russian troops who've been massed on the Ukrainian border. President of the European Commission Herman Van Rompuy says that efforts to find a solution to the crisis will continue.
We call on Russia to refrain from any steps to further destabilize Ukraine and instead to engage in a diplomatic resolution of the crisis. What we are doing is we keep open the track of negotiations and dialogue. We are even open to the idea of a second Geneva meeting.
There's been a further twist in Thailand's political crisis after the country's constitutional court ordered the prime minister to step down. It ruled Yingluck Shinawat had abused her power. It's the latest move in a lengthy campaign against her, which has seen mass protests on the streets in Bangkok. In Syria, rebel fighters and their families have been leaving the besieged city of Homs. The city had been the heart of the uprising against Bashar al-Assad's government, but under a deal brokered by the United Nations, rebels are now leaving after a siege lasting more than 2 years. Vietnamese officials say that naval vessels were deliberately rammed by Chinese ships as they tried to set up an oil rig in disputed waters. China claims the rig is within its territorial waters, but Vietnam claims the same area. No shots were fired on either side, but some Vietnamese sailors were injured when water cannons were used. Carl Thayer, who's a political analyst at New South Wales University in Australia, says it's a significant move in a long-running dispute.
China sending the oil rig in and of itself is a violation of the sovereignty of Vietnam. But in this case, it's not just an oil rig. It's a highly provocative action accompanied by 70 vessels of all types, small and Coast Guard, but including Chinese Navy ships. So this is a major escalation.
Voting is taking place in South Africa's general election, the first since the death of Nelson Mandela. The ruling ANC is expected to win around 60% of the vote, despite corruption claims and criticism of its handling of high unemployment. The elections come 20 years after the end of the apartheid regime and are the first in which some voters were born after the end of white minority rule. The man alleged to have hoarded works of art stolen by the Nazis has left all of them to a museum in Switzerland. Cornelis Gullit died on Tuesday, months after his collection of more than 1,400 pieces was found in an apartment in Munich. It's claimed many were taken illegally by the Nazis. The Bern Art Museum says the news of the bequest was a complete surprise, insisting it had no relationship with Mr. Gullit. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. And there'll be more news from Paul Osborne. He'll return with the headlines for you at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, as we tick towards 6 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House right here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and we'll be back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news of the day, right here in the studio are both the journalist Samira Shackle and Sky News politics reporter Darren McCaffrey. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start in Nigeria and the continuing plight of the hundreds of missing schoolgirls, abducted, of course, by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. I guess one of the real questions here to you both is what the world can do to affect change. Samira, what do you think about this? Because there's been quite a lot of discussion about the effectiveness of any external actors, or the lack of it, more like. What do you reckon of their chances of actually affecting a positive change here?
Yeah, I think that in that sort of discussion, the most important thing is to define what sort of change you want to be achieving and what precisely the problem is that's being spoken about. So I think there's sort of a tendency to jump on a problem, be very outraged about it, and then demand that something should be done, which is, I think, probably a sentiment that comes from a good place but is quite meaningless in and of itself. So I think in terms of the sort of specific problem at hand, which is the abduction of the more than 200 schoolgirls, I think that sort of strategic support can be given by foreign governments, as the US and the UK are doing, just sort of to help with the pure logistics of finding the girls. I think also there's probably some usefulness in the international pressure on the Nigerian government to take action, because I think that there were sort of, let's not forget, this happened 3 weeks ago before it sort of became a huge international story and there wasn't much government action taken. But I think you know, the Boko Haram insurgency has been going on since 2009. I think what would be very stupid would be sort of demand knee-jerk Western intervention, which is poorly thought out and doesn't really take into account the complexities of what is a very complex situation.
Darren, do you go along with that? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? There is often this tendency in the West for, you know, a bit of a soundbite-driven sort of political call and response. Do you think that, does it alarm you that may be happening to a degree?
Well, I think the two aspects of this story that are really interesting. First of all, what Samira just touched on is the fact that this happened 3 weeks ago. Now, this really only became an issue with what seemed like a social media campaign, Bring Our Girls Back, a matter of days ago. I remember at the end of last week, certainly campaigning started here about why we, as a media, were not covering this. Now, this is 200 girls. If this had been in America, in Australia, in parts of Europe, certainly even in places like China, it would have been a top story. We're talking about kind of a tragedy that's comparable to the ship that sank in off South Korea and the plane tragedy, which got quite a lot of attention. So I think we, as a media, have to ask a question about why it wasn't top of the agenda 2 weeks ago. But also, I think you're right about kind of Western intervention. Now, how good is Western intervention going to be? I'm sure for the parents of these schoolgirls, any help particularly the sophisticated militaries of America, Britain and France can do to find their children, they are all forward. In terms of the wider question, you have to remember, this is a problem that Nigeria is not dealing with very well.
We know we saw two bomb attacks in Abuja last week, which is a kind of step up for them. I think in total nearly 100 lives lost. And I think despite initial resistance from Good Luck Jonathan, I think there now has to be acceptance that actually any help for the West, particularly when it's now being offered, should be taken up.
We'll talk a bit more about Good Luck Jonathan's approach and maybe the bigger picture in terms of dealing with Boko Haram. But just on that point about, you alluded to it there, Darren, particularly this sort of Twitter campaign. We spoke to Tristan McConnell, Monocle's man in Nairobi, about how this is being covered in the region and whether there was a general sense of Western actors being sort of too late to the party, or an unease about that, certainly on the ground. And this is what he had to say.
What's interesting about the Bring Back Our Girls campaign that's happening at the moment, and what differentiates it from the American students who pushed the Darfur issue with the help of lots of celebrities, or more recently the Kony 2012 viral video a couple of years ago, is that this sort of hashtag is really being owned by the Nigerian people. And it's something that is ablaze on Nigerian social networks. So it doesn't have the feel of a kind of foreign imposition by well-meaning, if wrong-headed, activists. It feels more like a grassroots thing, a challenge to their own government from the Nigerian people. And that's why when I look at the campaign that's underway at the moment, I feel like it has perhaps a greater chance of success than some of these others.
Interesting insights from Monocle's Tristan McConnell there. Just Samir, on this final point then, ultimately, if some good is done, should it matter what the real drivers are, whether it's kind of, you know, Western guilt or, a hashtag campaign and questions about where the real drivers of that came from? Should we just say, well, if something positive comes of it, it was worth it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone would argue with sort of positive outcomes being a good thing. I think the question is whether there would be positive outcomes. And again, it sort of depends what you're talking about. I think it's certainly a good thing for, as Darren said, the sort of sophisticated military capabilities of the US and the UK to help in the pure fact of finding the girls. But I think if you're talking about, I mean, what then does Western intervention mean if it's about stopping Boko Haram? Does it mean invading northern Nigeria? Does it, what is it?
Well, I would say, though, Samir, that it means more than being done up until date. And it's clear that something needs to be done. I mean, for the people who live in this part of northern Nigeria, I mean, things can't really get an awful lot worse. I mean, talk today about hundreds potentially more dead because the Nigerian military has been taken away to look for these girls. So in a sense, Nigeria seems swamped. This has been going on a pretty full-scale mass for the last 5 years or so. I just think that any Western intervention can possibly in some ways make things worse.
Darren, interesting that point. You talked about the sort of redeployment of military that we've seen or we are seeing in the north of the country. Just a few years ago, there was quite a lot of criticism from human rights organisations and some other Western observers about how effective or ineffective the military was in dealing with this problem. And yet it's these very same military bodies now which are petitioning and in some cases being granted, additional help and assistance from the West. Is that a problem, that fundamentally we've got, the wrong people trying to solve this problem on the ground?
Well, precisely. And I'm sure that President Obama was talking about kind of getting kind of some of their top people on the ground to kind of maybe trying to wreck this, talking about using satellites, something that wouldn't have been available to the Nigerian military before this. Despite what I've just said, I think at the same time, there's been an argument that any intervention kind of from the West has to be targeted and doesn't, as we kind of seen in many other places, inflame things. But I do think that not just for the parents, but that, as I say, for the people who live in northern Nigeria, that things really can't get much worse and that any help that can be provided can be needed. But the fear is that obviously all the attention on this is giving Boko Haram what they actually want, which is worldwide recognition. And by essence, they're certainly getting that now.
Samir, just finally on the sort of attitude and response of Good Luck Jonathan, there's a feeling, I guess we also heard from Tristan McConnell when we spoke to him earlier, he talked a little bit about how Good Luck Jonathan had sort of treated Boko Haram as a problem that was far away, it was in the north, it was very separate from what was happening, and as Darren mentioned, these attacks in Abuja more directly and just the sheer scale of the coverage of this problem has maybe changed that. Has there been a collective failure by him and his administration, do you think, to deal with the immediacy and the sort of scale of the problem that Boko Haram poses?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, the that I think that's very starkly demonstrated by the fact that, you know, sort of the same day or the day before the schoolgirls were abducted, there was a bomb in Abuja and Goodluck Jonathan was on the scene instantly. It took 3 weeks for him to make a public statement on the abduction. So I think there certainly has been a collective failure. I'd be very cautious about the sort of attitude, which I think was sort of in what Darren was saying, that things can't possibly get worse. And I think from knee-jerk international intervention, things certainly can get worse. I mean, that often does cause a huge upsurge in civilian killings, civilian deaths. We've seen that all over the world. So I think there certainly needs to be more done. And it's been a very, very inadequate response from the Nigerian government so far. But we've seen that when they do take concerted action, they do make some small inroads against Boko Haram. I mean, since a state of emergency was declared last May, they've at least been pushed out of the cities in these states. Now, that hasn't been a concerted effort because this is a poor and disenfranchised area of the country and there just hasn't been the political impetus behind fighting it. But I think any sort of capacity building in that respect would be the best thing that foreign powers can do.
It's one we'll watch very closely. Let's move on now to Moscow, where President Putin has, amongst other things, he's been a busy man, of course, announced plans to compel online commentators and writers to register with the government. Now, Darren, what do you make of this? It's just a fairly unsubtle government initiative to restrict online voices, which can be quite damaging, and track people indeed who are active in those communities. Or is there any other justification that Putin would even seek to make about this?
Well, the justification that Putin is making is that online media, the internet, should be, because it is a form of broadcasting opinion, it should be regulated by the rules of publication, like newspapers and TV broadcasts are. And to be frank, of course, newspapers and TV broadcasts in most countries, in almost every country of the world, is regulated to some degree. But that hasn't necessarily extended to the internet in some ways. And it raises this interesting argument, because the flipping response to give is, well, this is a crackdown on the internet in Russia. We've seen it in China. We've seen it in Turkey. We've certainly seen it in places like Iran and elsewhere. And this is an attempt to subvert opposition. Now, to be frank, that probably is the case. And do it, of course, when everyone's attention's on the Ukraine, when he seems to be riding high with what they would view as a success in Crimea. But at the same time, I think, for example, there are questions in this country about the use of the internet and the law. We know that, particularly with the growth of Twitter, lots of people have used that to commit contempt of court, to name people's names. And there have been questions about how that should be regulated and whether Twitter needs to act or whether the law needs to come down on these people very heavily. And I'd also raise the other question as well, is that we assume that because the internet is free and accessible and that you can post anything in Western democracies, that is a good thing, and that is a responsible Western government response. But also we have to remember the internet has been used by Western governments for a large degree of surveillance on their own citizens as well. It's been used for their advantage to kind of track what people are doing. And so there are questions to say that maybe Vladimir Putin's just been a lot more open about stuff that potentially our Western governments are doing in some ways anyway.
It intrigues me, Samira. Further this week, he gave awards to a number of Russian journalists for their services to objective journalism. Yeah. Are you surprised by the kind of brass neck? Or maybe we shouldn't be at all anymore with Putin when it comes to that. But in terms of how he's tackling this, is it interesting what Darren says there? Maybe he's almost being just more candid than others. Or do you think it's still, regardless of that, is still some cause for alarm?
Perhaps? I think it's slightly different because of the context of Russia, in which we've seen dissent and opposition in all quarters from sort of activists and NGOs being suppressed, and should be seen in the context of other laws which restrict the sort of ability to protest and so on. And it should be seen in the context of the fact that Russia is quite consistently one of the most dangerous countries in the world to be a journalist. There have been, I think it's 50 or 60 journalists killed in the country since 1992. It's not a safe place to be a journalist who's sort of reporting on, say, government corruption. And so in that context, the fact that any website which has more than 3,000 viewers is sort of has the same sort of responsibilities and standards as a media outlet. And you sort of think, well, the conditions for mainstream media outlets aren't brilliant. So I think it... I mean, it's certainly true that governments all over the world, Western democracies and otherwise, are seeking to sort of police and restrict the internet in different ways. It's a hugely new and changing area of policy, but I think that you can't really detach it from a context in which dissent is increasingly criminalised.
Just briefly on this as well, Darren, he also brought these new profanity laws in, which are big fines for...
Precisely, of course, we couldn't use
particular
the words
on vulgarities. Yeah. Well, we probably can't. I just wonder, as a seasoned newsman, surely in your newsroom, no one would ever utter a profanity, would they, behind closed doors?
Well, certainly certainly not on air. I think what kind of stays off air stays off air. But again, I mean, I agree with Samir. I mean, we have to look at the track that Russia is going down, the authoritarianism that we see with Vladimir Putin. Though I do want to kind of just bounce it back onto kind of us, in a sense, the people who live in what we like to call kind of liberal democracies, and ask questions. I mean, there is a lot of talk about how to try and police the internet here as well, in terms of protecting particularly children, in terms of kind of sexual imagery, but also in terms of language, and talk about, for example, we've always had a watershed where certain programs were only allowed to be broadcast after a certain time. Now, the internet has changed that. You can go on at any point of the day and watch programs that would have been reserved for late night viewing. And there is talk about trying to implement some law to try and restrict that to protect children. So all I'm trying to get across is, yes, of course, kind of any sense of kind of clamping down on independent, impartial journalism in Russia is what we're seeing is bad. But at the same time, to kind of say that we in the West or in liberal democracies aren't also trying to curb freedoms of the internet through one means or another or for one cause or another isn't also true as well.
The jury may be out on that one too. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, here on Monocle 24. I shall be here with Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey when we return in just a moment. Don't go away.
The beret is not just a French cliché. It's a cherished piece of heritage at risk of extinction. Monocle Films pays a visit to the last beret maker in France and meets an Irishman trying to revive this quintessentially French piece of headwear.
L'Olaire has now earned the label of Living Heritage Company, Entreprise de Patrimoine Vivant, a reward from the French government to salute a firm's excellence in keeping alive a unique tradition. As the last manufacturer of a product so deeply ingrained in French DNA, L'Olaire and its berets are worth fighting for.
Vive le beret, premiering on Monocle.com.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via Monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches, and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists, and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, 1823 here in London. Still with me, I'm delighted to say, both the journalists, Samira Shackle and Sky News politics reporter, Darren McCaffrey. Samira and Darren, I'd like to shift our sights southwards to South Africa next. The country's obviously been going to the polls today. Historic elections, 20 years since the end of white majority rule, the first elections indeed since the death of Nelson Mandela, sort of pregnant with so much history. And I wondered, before we consider the sort of political, the likely political outcomes, to look at the sort of democratic state of the nation. How important is it, Samira, in your view, that we've got this, well, first generation of voters in many cases who have been born and have been raised in a completely democratic country? It's a pretty sort of astonishing stage that South Africa has reached.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just that fact in and of itself, as you say, I mean, that's certainly going to change the political reality over the coming years. I think it's quite interesting and quite sad, really, that only about a third of those people who are, I don't know, the age of sort of 19 or so, are in that age bracket, are actually registered to vote. Mm-hmm. So despite the fact that this group has sort of come to adulthood and come to voting age, they're not going to be as decisive in this election as they might be. I think that might start to change. And I think probably a large part of the reason for that is because there just simply isn't really a viable alternative to the ANC, and people are quite disillusioned with the ANC. But I think it's very interesting. I mean, this year you have, I think, 29 parties standing for election, but not really one that's a proper alternative to the ANC. And you have the ANC standing on a platform that's still, 20 years later, largely about ending apartheid, about the sentimentality around Mandela's death. And I mean, there's no doubt that those are hugely resonant and powerful emotional and political messages. But I think certainly over the next decade or so, they're going to have to sort of buck up their ideas and get some concrete policy sort of campaigns.
Darren, let me ask you about that specifically, because we've been hearing a lot in the last sort of 18 months, over 2 years, about a slightly, an apathetic sense in a lot of communities in South Africa, a disillusionment, not just with the ANC, but I guess with the whole sort of political class there. They're corrupt, corruption is endemic, and there's, different politicians, but they say the same things. Have you been surprised that, parties like the Democratic Alliance haven't been better able on a national scale to come close to unseating the ANC? Because without preempting what happens today, it does appear they will win a fairly comfortable return.
No, not really. Not really. Because I think in any kind of post-conflict society, particularly a society where it's decided that kind of one group or one party has taken a country to a position that most of the citizens would like to see in, that as Samir said, is a very, very, very powerful message, and it's going to take a long time to move away from that. I have to, if we talk about South Africa today, to anyone on the street, people will talk about Oscar Pistorius. They're not going to be talking about the election in South Africa. And that in some ways sums up the kind of success and failure of South Africa in many ways. First of all, the fact that we're not talking about the elections, they seem to be happening pretty peacefully, not with at all much corruption, in terms of they seem to be free and actually democratic. But at the same time, the fact we're talking about Oscar Pistorius is a sign that, for example, the crime is still pretty rife, that there are questions about... I remember watching a report yesterday by lots of black South Africans saying that it was a black man accused of killing his girlfriend. He certainly wouldn't have been given bail when he was up for a murder trial. He would have been remanded in custody. And that's a sign that kind of race tensions remain. But at the same time, I think we're a bit down on South Africa. And we have to remember, this is a country more than most kind of post-conflict societies that's moved on pretty well. And the ANC, to be fair, have had a pretty good hand in that. I mean, I'm reading statistics here that say that kind of 41% of South Africans lived in poverty in 1994. That's down to 31%. 31% too high, but it's still on the way down. Millions more have access now to decent housing and electricity. The economy is growing at a reasonably decent rate for the last 20 years. It's not exploded. It's not doing necessarily well in comparison to other African countries, but it's steadily getting better. There's a new black middle class that's emerging. And so I think we have to remember, when countries move quite quickly from one thing to another, it's very easy for them to kind of implode and move backwards again, or the violence to strike up. And yes, there are big problems. The big problems of crime and big problems with the white community leaving, dissatisfaction, corruption. But there has been significant progress, and I think we can forget that all too easily.
Exactly. It's still a relatively young democracy. Perhaps we need to grant them a little more time. Well, we'll certainly be charting the developments as related to the election in the coming days here on Monaco 24. Just before we allow you both to leave, I did want to talk a little bit about Syria. The rebel-held city of Homs has been evacuated today, a part of a deal with government. It was the sort of last stronghold for the rebels, and can be seen as yet another sort of big propaganda success, and also another strategic success for Bashar al-Assad. Samira, is it sort of fair to say now, without any equivocation, that Assad has won this war as it has been in Syria?
I'd be reluctant to make any sort. I mean, just we've seen so many sort of changes, at sea changes during the conflict. I think it's certainly a huge symbolic victory as well as a strategic victory. I mean, it gives Assad control of the whole sort of central swathe of Syria, And, you know, this was seen as the sort of capital of the rebellion, and it sort of withstood a quite brutal siege for upwards of 2 years. So it's certainly a huge victory, and it will certainly, I think, make Assad and his government even less willing to sort of sit round the negotiating table, I think, with such big battlefield successes.
And Darren, just a final thought from you. Should not just the residents of Homs, or those few that remain, prepare for, you know, an ongoing sort of attritional guerrilla war battle, or could there be something more optimistic down the line? How would you characterise the situation?
I really think it's probably the former, in that I think we are kind of looking at almost a kind of Chechen style kind of guerrilla warfare scenario. Just kind of trying to loop it back to kind of what we were talking about at the very start about Nigerian intervention, and obviously Syria is a sign of a lack of intervention. There was an intervention as well last September, and it dissipated. And actually, I know Samir might kind of slightly disagree with this, but where intervention has gone wrong, and of course it's gone wrong in the past, there are signs where a lack of intervention, without a shadow of doubt, has allowed al-Assad to make these gains. And there are questions for the international community about how are we now going to deal with the fact that al-Assad remains, that effectively pure and utter brutality has worked. Just killing and killing and killing again has worked. And I think that raises lots of questions, not just for Syria as it tries to cope beyond these elections in June, but also for international leaders about what to do in future conflicts.
Some sobering questions there being asked by Darren McCaffrey. We're also hearing from Samira Shackle. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on today's Midori House.
Thanks a lot. Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our correspondent in Mali, talk television with Stacey Wilson from The Hollywood Reporter, and yes, we'll meet the would-be winners of this year's Eurovision Song Contest, Team Armenia. But before all of that excitement, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who's got the latest world news headlines.
In the latest attack in Nigeria, blamed on the Islamist militant group Boko Haram, it's feared as many as 300 people may have been killed. So far, 125 bodies have been recovered from a village in the northeast of the country, 3 weeks after Boko Haram seized more than 200 schoolgirls. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has signalled an apparent U-turn in his policy towards Ukraine, calling a planned presidential election there this month a step in the right direction. He's also called on pro-Russian separatists in the southeast of the country to abandon plans for an independence referendum, though NATO has said there's no evidence to support Mr. Putin's claim that he's withdrawn tens of thousands of Russian troops from the border. In a further twist in the political crisis in Thailand, the country's constitutional court has ordered the Prime Minister to step down. It ruled Yingluck Shinawat abused her power in the latest move in a lengthy campaign against her. Rebel fighters and their families have spent the day leaving the besieged Syrian city of Homs. The city, which had once been the heart of the uprising against Bashar al-Assad's government, is being evacuated under a deal brokered by the United Nations. And Vietnamese officials say that naval vessels were deliberately rammed by Chinese ships as they tried to set up an oil rig in disputed waters. China claims the rig is within its territorial waters, but Vietnam claims the same area. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news from Paul Osborne at the top of the hour. He'll be back at 1900 hours London time. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And it is time next on the programme to check in with one of our many correspondents around the world. Today, we're heading to Bamako, where our correspondent Alex Duval-Smith is ready and waiting. Alex, great to speak with you as always. Let's start off by talking about, aid and whether it's been spent well or poorly. What are people talking about aid where you are?
Yeah, well, it's a year. It's going to be a year next week since a donor conference in Brussels met and pledged just over 3 billion euros, a record amount for Mali. You'll recall at the time the French intervention was at its height and Mali seemed to be emerging from the Islamist occupation of the north and the war against the rebels. So the entire world rallied to the Malian cause. And I've been looking at ahead of this anniversary, I've been looking at just what's been happening to the 3 billion euros. It's quite hard to take the figure apart. I've been speaking to a few diplomats here in Bamako. 1.8 billion, so two-thirds of it, comes from 54 participants at that Brussels conference last year. People like the World Bank, USAID, Arab States, the Islamic Development Bank. And some was loans, some was renewed pledges, and some was gifts. And then you have 1.2 billion euros coming from the European Union and its member states. Again, the member states, quite tricky often, re-pledging aid. You've got, for example, Belgium, which actually renewed a pledge which it's already made. The United Kingdom, which has an aid program for the Sahel, so that's four countries in total, and includes its Mali budget in there. And then you come down to the nitty-gritty. And what's interesting at the moment is that of the money that came from the European Commission, which was 500 million euros, half of it was direct budgetary aid to the government. And that's where we're going to be looking in the next few days for real indications from diplomats from Brussels and for convincing arguments from the Malian government that more should be released, because so far about half of that has been released. 105 million euros are in the balance as checks, really. I mean, blank checks is perhaps putting it too flippantly, but a check that will go straight into the state budget if the European diplomats decide that Mali's doing a good job.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about spending, or public spending of sorts, presidential spending more specifically, because I gather the media there is fairly exercised about where a particular $40 million may have gone. Tell us about this.
Well, yes, and this is actually a loan, a five-year loan that the Malian government has taken out, and it's going to be grist to the mill of the European diplomats who are critical of the way President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta is running the government that he came into power to run in August last year. He's used $40 million to buy a presidential plane. Now, you might consider that to be normal for a country to have a plane rather than leasing one, which is expensive. However, the previous deposed president, Amadou Toumani Touré's plane, is sitting on the tarmac here in Bamako. So what it comes down to is that the new president doesn't want to use the old president's plane. And when you ask the president's office what's wrong with using the old president's plane, apparently it was a gift from Gaddafi. Well, you know, a gift is a gift, isn't it? It wasn't a gift to the president himself. It was a gift to Mali, one presumes. So this is very much in the air at the moment. People are not happy that $40 million has just been spent on a not brand new, but a very smartly kitted out Boeing 737 that Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta wants to use for travelling around.
That's the president then. What about the new Prime Minister, Moussa Mara? He's new in the office. Presumably when you get it behind the desk, you've got an in tray with all sorts of challenges to tackle. What are the first things he's done? Are they all been very predictably mundane political meetings?
You would imagine there would be a few things to deal with, like the state of education, the health service, the non-existent rubbish collection in Bamako. But in fact, what he did was organise an evening of drinks with Bamako's rappers, the Urban Culture Collective. Now, it's quite interesting because the rappers have been saying a lot of bad things about people in authority. And this has obviously got the government upset, and the new Prime Minister Moussa Mara, who's quite young himself, he's only 39, would like to put a stop to this. And I think, I mean, anyone who follows Malian music at all might not be aware of the importance of Malian rap, because what we hear of in the rest of the world is Amadou and Mariam and Tinari Wen, all lovely, very well-researched music. But what really hits home here in Bamako is the rap. And it's the rap in Bambara, which is the local language here, and it's highly critical of abuses by mayors who sell plots of land four and five times that aren't even theirs, of the dire state of public service, of the non-existent state often of public service and education. And they've been hammering home this message increasingly, and inspired, I think, probably by Malian rappers who've broken through in the French suburbs, who are very critical in their lyrics. Now they're doing it in Bambara. And so what does Moussa Mara do? In his first week in office, he holds a meeting with the rappers to ask them to, please, will you shut up?
Well, Alex, let's stay in sort of musical realm then, because I gather, as well as perhaps being slightly disillusioned about rappers getting in a sit-down with the PM, the chattering classes are also upset about, if not a music, a new dance. Tell us why they're so exercised by this.
Well, yes, it's Sabani. Sabani is a new dance that's reached Mali from Senegal. And are you standing up?
I'm now ready. I'm now standing, so I'm ready.
Are you standing? Okay, so bend your knees slightly as if to ski.
Perfect.
And then stick out your bum.
This is my usual dancing position.
Okay, well, that's because you're off to a good start for Sabani then. Start moving your knees from sort of left to right in a flexing movement, and that'll
great.
Get your bum wobbling a bit.
Oh, it's certainly wobbling
and
right now.
And now start wobbling your stomach a bit. So it's similar to a belly dance.
Oh, beautiful,
and if
beautiful
you imagine
shapes
in a
I'm casting
staunchly,
here.
And if you were a girl, you would have lifted your skirt by now to expose your bum.
I am wearing a skirt. I'll lift that up a little. Why not?
Oh, that's a very, very coincidence.
I'm very enlightened, Alex, you see.
Yeah. And Sabani is catching on, and I'm afraid causing the chattering classes here to express a lot of shock. This is a Muslim country, after all, where women don't cover up sort of in sort of dark black, you know, miserable clothes. They wear quite brightly coloured clothes, but women are expected to cover their heads, their shoulders, their arms, and definitely their bottoms. Sabani is catching on. Is very popular among young Mali here in Bamako, quite a lot in the media at the moment, and quite interesting, because you can't sort of go out and buy a Sabani soundtrack. Sabani is just generally danced to a single drum beat.
I was doing my very best Sabani moves there, Alex. Will you be taking to the streets for a spot of Sabani sometime? I don't know, maybe this evening, perhaps?
Yeah, you and I, we could come over to Bamako and we'll do a bit of Sabani. Although by now, if you'd really followed my instructions, you would be in a trance-like state.
Oh, I'm sometimes there anyway. Alex Duval-Smith in Bamako with all the latest Sabani news as well. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. More music on the way next when we meet Armenia's contender for this year's Eurovision Song Contest title. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. It is Eurovision time. Yesterday we found out the 10 countries that went through in the first semi-final of the show. Hot favourites, according to the bookmakers. Armenian singer Aram MP3 was one of them. No surprise there, as it will be more likely that the event will be hosted in Yerevan next year. Our Eurovision editor, I think that's what he's called, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, chatted to Aram MP3 a little earlier.
I'm a comedian, I'm a pharmacist, and I'm a singer. So I have three professions. But my first profession is a singer, of course. So now I'm working with music. The second one is a comedian, and the third one is a pharmacist. But I'm not working now like a pharmacist. Now I'm a singer, and second one a comedian.
How were you selected for Eurovision in Armenia? Because, you know, every country has a different method of choosing the artist. How is it in Armenia?
This year, about 6 months ago, Armenian television told me about my participating in a Eurovision Song Contest. So it was a nice surprise for me. I really want to participate in Eurovision Song Contest till 2006. So I hope that one day I will be on this stage and will sing my song. So it's like a dream for me.
Well, and here you are. And also, Armenia is quite recent in the contest. I mean, I think Armenia is in Eurovision since 2006. And apparently you're one of the favorites. How do you feel about that?
Oh, it's a great feeling, you know, like be the favorite one, to see good comments and feedback. So it's a pleasure. Of course, it's a pleasure and it's good memories. And I have a lot of friends here. I met Basim from Denmark. Now we are good friends, and I hope that I will see every participant and we will have good memories from Eurovision.
And also I want to talk a little bit about the song now, Not Alone. I mean, the video is impressive and it's quite a powerful song. I mean, what was the inspiration of the song?
I wrote this song, it came from my heart, so I wrote this song about 10 minutes, so it's like coming from my heart. Because I love the symphonic orchestra and the electronic music, so we wanted to mix that, like we mixed symphonic orchestra and dubstep, and that was great. And my friend Garik Papoyan, this is my colleague from comedy club, our comedy club, he wrote the words, the lyrics, and Lilit Navasarjan did the great arrangement for this song.
And what can we expect from your performance, if you can tell us?
I will be on a stage alone. I'm going to show my feelings, like human feelings, when he feels that he is alone and how he want to solve his problem. So sometimes you feel that you have no way you can find a door for your solution. So you must just look around and you must focus. You must fight for your rights and fight for your love. And you must show everyone that you are not alone.
Wise words indeed from Aram MP3 there, talking to our Eurovision editor, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who is heading to Copenhagen tomorrow morning. He'll be bringing you all the latest from the event, including the thrilling finale as we head towards the weekend. I want to play some music now on Midori House, and well, I think we all know where we have to go. Let's keep it Eurovision. Let's keep it Armenian. Let's hear from Aram MP3. This is Not Alone. The unmistakable sound of Aram MP3 with Not Alone there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is time now to review the best, maybe the worst, of cinema, music, media, theatre and the arts. Today we're talking television. I'm joined live on the line now, I'm happy to say, by Stacey Wilson from The Hollywood Reporter in Los Angeles. Lots to talk about, Stacey, but I feel I must ask you first, what did you make of Aram MP3's Not Alone there? A big Eurovision fan, do you think that was any good?
Being all the way out here, I haven't been able to spend too much time with it. But it was actually a beautiful, very beautiful. I need to catch up on my music. I'm a little too entrenched in movies and TV.
Well, it only took him 10 minutes to write that. I felt like I could maybe tell, but maybe you beg to differ. Let's talk television.
Nice.
Let's talk TV instead. Then let's talk about Louis first. Remind us about this. There's been a bit of a gap. We've had a bit of a wait. Will it be worth the wait?
Yes, so this is season 4 of Louis, of course the wonderful dramedy on FX created by comedian Louis C.K., personal favorite of mine, and the new season is absolutely spectacular. I marathoned the first 4 episodes via screeners that they sent out, and I didn't think that he'd be able to top himself, and he has. The stories are just wonderful. The situations are even more awkward and painful, which for me is just beautiful, beautiful storytelling. And FX is actually marathoning them this week, I think large in part to make them eligible for this year's Emmys, because series have to air before the end of May to be eligible for this year's awards, which are being held in August, a month earlier this year because of NBC's schedule. Mm. But yeah, it's great stuff. And oddly enough, I'm actually speaking to Louis later today for another story, so I'll be able to gush to him over the phone.
That's always good. I'm just intrigued. Is it part of his sort of, you know, his unique shtick, his character, that he sort of was able to have this delay? Because I guess a lot of people, if they've got a popular show, a hit show, there's so much pressure to just keep churning them out. Do you think it's part of the kind of the Louis C.K. mythology almost that gives him a bit more latitude?
It is, and I can tell you that FX, he is one of their most prized possessions of all time. He was essentially given carte blanche to make a pilot 5 years ago with a certain amount of money, and he turned it in, and they said, great, and they put it on TV, and I can tell you that never happens. And I think he and Larry David sort of share rarefied air in the sense that they can kind of just do whatever they want because they're so valued as auteurs and comedians that I think HBO and FX respectively are sort of at their behest waiting, okay, are you ready? Are you ready? and we're still waiting for Curb Your Enthusiasm to come back. I don't know where it is. It's floating off in space somewhere. But, you know, when it does come back, we'll all be there, ready and waiting.
and without wishing to issue any kind of spoiler alerts, fans of the series already, it's going to be more of the same? Or does it kind of take us in any different directions without sort of giving away the gems of the episodes you've watched? It's still delivered.
It does. What's nice about Louis is that each episode exists as its own piece of storytelling. You don't really have to have seen previous episodes. There isn't like a long narrative arc where, you know, events in this episode affect events in the next episode, which makes it feel like a little beautiful indie film that you can just watch as a piece of art, and you don't really have to know what has happened in the past. There's a wonderful episode where there's a woman he works with at the comedy club who has interested him, and I won't give away details, but it's just one of the most beautiful sort of testaments to dating and expectations of how people should look, and what is being overweight is does that figure into someone's worth and how they should be viewed by the opposite sex. It was a beautiful, beautiful episode. And not funny per se. That's the thing. I don't really laugh when I watch it. I just sit there and go, God, I wish I'd written that. I'm just sort of seething with jealousy as a writer that
I
could never make such beautiful storytelling.
That's always the way to go. Let's move on and talk a little bit about, Showtime's new show, Penny Dreadful. Tell us about this. Lots of big names, a lot of kind of British stalwarts in there, but, you know, great talent from all around that's been brought together. Tell us how they've done it.
Well, essentially, this is so Dexter's off the air. That was kind of like their longstanding horror franchise that had a great run, ended last year. So I think they probably felt like we need our Game of Thrones, we need our fantasy, gory, fantastical piece of storytelling. And this is a very interesting show. I watched the first 2 episodes yesterday. John Logan, of course, very celebrated screenwriter. This is coming from him and Sam Mendes, of course, you know, one of your greats. And it's essentially, I think one writer said it best, it's a monster mashup. It takes place in Victorian England, London, 1891, and Eva Green and Timothy Dalton play this very mysterious, bizarre couple who hire Josh Hartnett's character to help them recover their daughter from vampires. Of course, you know, this happens to people every day. and in the process of this, we get entrenched in this gothic world of monsters, and what we end up experiencing is we meet all these different monsters from different stories. So we meet Dr. Frankenstein, who's at this point a young doctor sewing people's limbs together, so of course we know how that turns out. We meet Dorian Gray, and beyond that, I haven't seen enough episodes to kind of, you know, see the full reveal, but I think it's going to be fun for fans of horror. There's a kitsch factor. There's, you know, a lot of nods to previous stories. It's just beautiful. It reminds me a little bit of the Sherlock Holmes franchise. Mm. the Robert Downey Jr. It has that kind of same look, but it's fun too. It's not overly serious because, you know, when you're making horror these days, you have to have a wink to the audience that, okay, we get it. This is kind of absurd, but we hope it's fun. And it is. It looks great, too. It's very beautiful.
Good. So, well, and with that cast, it sounds like it will have a kind of operatic, theatrical sense of joie de vivre, too, which is surely to make it a success. Let's talk a little bit before we finish, Stacey, about a couple of the hits of the sort of new broadcast season. Not too many to choose from. Where should we start? Maybe tell us a bit about The Blacklist. This has been well received, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, and actually, as we sit here chatting, this week and next week is sort of the, either if you're a TV writer, the worst week of your career or the best week. This is when the networks announce which shows are coming back and which ones are not. And The Blacklist certainly is among those. It was the number one broadcast new drama of the year on NBC. Enormous ratings. And actually, a good friend of mine wrote the show, a guy I've known for 20 years, who has segued from film to television, John Bokenkamp. So it's been very exciting to watch the show kind of flourish, because it really does satisfy this. You know, NBC didn't have a gritty, cool drama in their lineup. They had a lot of old shows. Law & Order SVU, 14 seasons in, it's still a great show, but it doesn't have that, you know, I need to tweet about this. And I think The Blacklist has really tapped into social media. And James Spader is just killing it. I mean, this guy, it's just the role he was born to play, which is really exciting. And then another Universal show, not an NBC, but Universal Studio show on Fox, Brooklyn Nine-Nine comedy starring Andy Samberg, has also been a big hit of the year. Not enormous numbers, but it did win the Golden Globe, shockingly sort of beat Girls and all these other shows in January. And Andy Samberg won Best Actor in a Comedy at the Globe. So I think those two have stood out as being commercial and critical hits for Universal, so they had a great year as a studio.
Fantastic stuff. Those are the insights and views of Stacey Wilson from The Hollywood Reporter. Stacey, thanks as always for joining us, and we'll speak to you again very soon, I hope, here on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. Special thanks in particular to Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey, my guests earlier. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Michaela Aitken and Harriet Baker, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next up, off the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs, presented by Daniel. Tune in for a chat about fitness in Finland, cosmetics in Barcelona, hospitality in New Zealand, and beer in Canada, among other audio delights. At 2200 hours London time tonight, of course, will be time for the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller and Marcus Hippie in the chairs for that one. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, as if you needed reminding. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.